chromosomes. Little strands of nucleic acids and proteins are the fundamental genetic instructions that tell us who we are at birth. Most people are born with 46 chromosomes, but each year in the United States, about 6,000 people are born with an extra chromosome, making them a person with Down syndrome. If you've ever encountered someone with Down syndrome, you know that they are some of the kindest, most joyful people you will ever meet. They truly have something extra. My name is Lisa Nichols, and I have spent the last 24 years as both the CEO of Technology Partners and as the mother to Allie. Allie has something extra in every sense of the word. I have been blessed to be by her side as she impacts everyone she meets. Through these two important roles as CEO and mother to Allie, I have witnessed countless life lessons that have fundamentally changed the way I look at the world. While you may not have an extra chromosome, every leader has something extra that defines who you are. Join me as I explore the something extra in leaders from all walks of life and discover how that difference in each of them has made a difference in their companies, their families, their communities, and in themselves. If you like this episode today, please go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and leave us a 5-star rating. I'm excited to have Vince Vitale on the show today. Vince is an author, podcast host, executive director of Cardia, and faculty scholar at the CEO Forum. Well, Vince Vitale, it is so good to have you on the Something Extra podcast today, my friend. Thank you so much for making the time. I've been really excited about our conversation.
Oh, me too. It's a real pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Yes. Well, I always love to tell our listeners how they always want to know, how do you get connected to the people that you have on? And you and I know one another through an organization that we both love, and that is the CEO Forum. And we can talk a little bit more about that. But yeah, you and your wife both are involved in the forum. And I think I maybe met Joe at the Executive Women's Retreat. Maybe met her before I met you, but yeah.
I think that's right. She loved that time together.
It was great. It was great. And I was telling you, we kind of were talking about in a sidebar conversation, I was thinking about this year for the forum is its 30th anniversary.
And I know I'm looking forward to it. Coming with some friends and my wife, it's going to be fantastic.
Yes. It, you know, like not such a great place. The island. They could have done a little better, but we'll be celebrating in October. Got some great lineup of speakers and that I'm really excited to hear from. But I was telling you, and I did not realize this, and I didn't put two and two together until I started preparing for this episode. And Technology Partners, we will be celebrating our 30th here in St. Louis at the Four Seasons in September.
Oh, that's fantastic.
30 years.
So. I'm glad it didn't fall on the same weekend.
I am really glad of that too. That would have been awful. We would have had a hard choice to make. But, you know, we've got so much. I've got pages and pages of notes here of things I want to talk to you about. I just know that the things we're going to talk about, I'm really hoping and praying that they help our listeners. But before we get into a lot of that, I really want you to take me back to your childhood. Where did you grow up? And then we'll talk about other things.
Sure. I grew up in New Jersey. That's sort of ingrained in you when you're from Jersey. You know, it just kind of comes out after your name, Vince Vitale from New Jersey. A great Italian-American name that I was given, Vincent Raphael Vitale Jr. And so, yeah, I came from an Italian-American family. And, you know, as I reflect on my childhood, two things that stand out. You know, my parents weren't really afforded the opportunity to go to college, but they were really hard workers. And so those wound up being two of the really high values in my household, prioritizing education, because my parents didn't have that chance. And so they really stressed that they wanted that for me and for my brother. And then and also hard work. My dad used to just have this little mantra, 100%. And he would just say it, you know, from the sideline of a soccer game or something, and all he had to do was say that one word, and I would just kick into gear, right? You know, especially in sports, just give it everything I absolutely had, to the point that now on my birthday, I'll often get social media posts from people I haven't seen in decades or spoken to in decades, and they'll just write 100% on my social media platforms, because it's even so vivid for them. My dad just instilling this for me from a young age.
I love that 100%. So when he said that, you're like giving it everything you got, and you watched him do that, I'm sure. Well, I was going to ask you about sports. I presume that you did play sports, because we'll talk about this, but you went on and played soccer in university, and then even at Oxford. What sports did you play as a little guy?
I played pretty much everything as a little guy, you know, baseball, basketball, soccer. Didn't really have the size for football or basketball for that matter, but I tried. I loved sports. It's a hugely formative part of my experience of my childhood, but just my development, you know, as a person as well. Played through college, got to play for a few more years in graduate school when I was over in England. I boxed for 3 years as a graduate student over at Oxford, and then I met my wife Jo, and we got engaged, and she said it was time to take up golf. So that was the end of the boxing career.
That's hilarious. What about pickleball? Have you picked up pickleball? Because that's a hot topic these days.
You're so right. And so everyone in my church is playing pickleball. So I'm sort of being forced into pickleball, but it's really fun. Pickleball and a bit of tennis as well, and I'm not very good at this. I was actually the other day, I was watching YouTube videos on like proper tennis swing. So you know, now you can learn anything. Just watch the YouTube video. Unfortunately, it's a bit harder when I get out on the court, but I do. I love sports. One of my struggles now as I am in middle age, trying to figure out which sports I can play without getting injured.
Exactly. I hear you. Oh my goodness. Well, let's back up just a little bit, because you kind of talked about playing soccer, but you know, you got a BA in philosophy at Princeton. Princeton's one of the 8 Ivy League schools. I mean, Vince, that's amazing that your parents didn't have that opportunity, but they wanted to make sure that you and your brother were educated really well. You played soccer for Princeton. So you are a scholar athlete, my friend. You don't get to go to Princeton without being a scholar. And then here you are, played sports as well.
I guess so. I'm very, very thankful for that, looking back. And it's sort of amazing to reflect on it and to realize that, you know, the ability to take that path actually had a lot more to do with my parents' encouragement than even what they could sort of practically help me with. You know, they didn't have the education to kind of come alongside me after a certain point and, you know, help me with my math homework or help me with my science homework. And it's always sort of struck me that, if you look at my sort of background and upbringing, it just wouldn't have been the obvious place to wind up at a university like Princeton. But I think it did teach me a lot about how much kind of the issues of the heart and just the encouragement of where your motivation comes from goes a lot further than even some of the practical resources around you in terms of where you wind up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well said. Well, in that 100%, given 100%, you know, that your dad instilled in you. So let me ask you this. What was the precipice for studying philosophy? Was there a certain person in your life who inspired you? Because let me just say, my husband, Greg, his maternal grandfather, Granddaddy Joe, never made it past 8th grade, Vince.
Okay.
But he read all the time, and especially philosophy. And he and Greg would sit and have these philosophical discussions. I really do believe that Greg's grandfather is the one that really inspired him. But did you have somebody that inspired you?
You know, it's a really interesting question. I've often reflected on why I wound up. I actually went into college knowing I wanted to study philosophy, but I had never taken a philosophy class in my life. But I just sort of knew that's how my mind worked, that I asked kind of deep, big questions about life. And so I'm not sure, you know, where that came from. I think that was kind of more of a God-given wiring. But I would say that my parents really welcomed my questions from a young age, even if they didn't have, you know, comprehensive answers to my questions. There's something about, you know, just not having your questions dismissed or pushed away, but they really encouraged me to ask those types of questions. And so I think that just ingrained a curiosity that then, you know, led into what I studied. And I think also my parents, they really encouraged me to study where my passions were, as opposed to what they had done or what they thought would be useful. And I'm really thankful for that as well.
Mm-hmm. Another good parenting lesson there, I think. But let me ask you this, because I know that when you went into Princeton, you were a skeptic. But can you share your journey from skeptic to evangelist?
Oh, wow. Sure. I'd love to. So I was playing soccer at the university, and I had two teammates who were, they were a year older than me, and they invited me to a meeting of athletes in action, which it turns out was a Christian community on campus, but I had no idea what I was being invited to. I just knew it had, you know, athlete in the title, and I was being invited by my teammates. And so I went along, we walked in a few minutes late to this gathering of students, and I walked into this group of students, sort of with their eyes closed, singing their hearts out to this invisible God. And I had never experienced anything like that. I found it very disorienting, because these were, you know, successful Princeton students. They were scholar athletes. You know, what need would they have for to depend on a kind of wishful thought like God? This was kind of the mindset, you know, that I was in. And I started to listen to even some of the lyrics of the songs. And, you know, my philosophy of life up until this point was all about winning. It was all about being the best, being better than other people, beating other people, being at the top of the food chain. And here were these students, athletes, people who seemed to be like me, but they were singing to God precisely because they were proclaiming that he was better than them. And that was why they actually wanted to follow him. So it was just a very disorienting experience for me. And I remember walking out that evening, and it may be the first sort of sincere prayer that I prayed. I would sort of call it an agnostics prayer. And I just remember saying, God, I don't know if I'm talking to anyone, but if I am, I'd really like to know about it. And there's sort of a longer story of journeying with that community and them helping me through a lot of the hard philosophical questions that I had to journey through for things to make their way from my head to my heart. But that was the starting point for my journey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think I read something, or maybe I made this up. Could have made it up. I don't know, because I read a lot. But I feel like one of your friends kind of challenged you to read the Bible. To start reading the Bible. Is that right?
Absolutely.
Did I make that up?
No, you're okay. You're absolutely right. One of those soccer teammates. And so I was only half interested, but, you know, kind of always up for a challenge. And I started to read through, and I found myself really two things. One, I found myself very drawn to the person of Jesus, the way that he treated people, the way that he cared for such a diversity of people. And then as I kept reading, in particular, I got into a book called Acts of the Apostles. And it's a book that sort of recounts some of the early history of the earliest Christian believers. And all over that book, I started finding words like reasoned, debated, confirmed, explained, you know, even proved at times. There were all these sort of intellectual words about the fact that they were thinking about the faith and coming to certain conclusions and then sharing that faith with others in a rational way. And that sort of blew my conception of blind faith. I thought it was just a sort of emotional thing. You have it or you don't. You take a blind leap or you don't. And I was already a philosopher. I was studying philosophy. I wasn't willing to park my brain at the door. But now reading through the Bible after this challenge from my teammate, and I was sort of forced to come to the conclusion, this doesn't sound like a God who's asking me to leave my brain behind, but asking me to actually love him and follow him in part through using my mind well. So that that was the next step for me. And that kind of opened up the possibility of, oh, I could pursue this journey with integrity.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Well, you went on, went on and went to Oxford. I'm presuming this. I don't want to presume, but what inspired you to do that? I'm thinking the apologetics route may be part of that, but what inspired you to go to Oxford?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I already had that kind of wiring for philosophy, not knowing where that came from, very different from what my parents did or what my background was. But then when faith became a sort of living dynamic thing in my life, it was like all of a sudden it made sense why I would have that philosophical wiring. And I think there's like a kind of a kindness of God to sort of put me on that path before I even knew him in any sort of significant way. So, yeah, I did go to Oxford to study more philosophy and theology. And it was just such a part of my own life and what was in my heart. I wanted to understand more this God that I felt I had come into contact with and was becoming a part, not just of my abstract thinking, but of my day-to-day life. And so I continue to study the deep questions around him. And in large part, what I do today is helping people with their questions, their deep questions of life. And so in some ways, playing the part for others that those two teammates played for me at the start of my journey.
Well, thank you. You just set me up. That was the perfect segue.
Excellent.
Thank you, Vince. I want to get into some of these deep questions. While you were doing research at Oxford, you developed a new response to the problem of evil. And this is discussed in your book, Non-Identity Theodicy.
Nailed it.
A grace based response to the problem of evil. Can you unpack this for a little bit, Vince, and maybe touch on some of the core concepts?
Oh, sure. Sure. You know, it was probably one of the first questions that I got asked after I got serious about my Christian faith was by my aunt Regina. And she detailed some of the suffering in her son's life, my cousin Charles. And after she was done speaking about that and asking, you know, why would a good, powerful, loving God allow this to happen? I was sort of immature and overzealous and started to spout some of my sort of abstract philosophical explanations for why God might allow suffering in the world. And my aunt listened very patiently, graciously, and then she turned to me and she said, "But Vince, that doesn't speak to me as a mother." And it was, it wasn't a harsh response. It was a caring response and a really significant response in my life. And so as I discerned what topic to treat in my PhD work, I wanted something that connected with my story. I wanted something that was a question that real people have, not just philosophers in their ivory towers, and a question that's not going away, not a question that was sort of, you know, in vogue for a few years, but a few years from now, nobody will have that question anymore. And I think I always had my Aunt Regina in the back of my mind as well. So I wanted to think about what the approaches to that question could be that were personal in nature and that could give hope and that could be focused on, you know, love for the individual and not just abstract ideas. Mm-hmm. So that was the starting point.
Very good. Very good. Well, I know that you have a strong interest in reconciliation, leadership, and the theology of work, as well as the intersection of faith and sport. And I would love to just do a quick debrief of each of these areas. And then when we get to leadership, we may save that one for last because I've got some other questions for you on leadership. But let's just start with reconciliation. What have you learned about reconciliation, Vince?
Oh, wow. How significant it is and how bad I was at it, but how beautiful
it
is.
Those are two things you learn.
You know, it's hard. It's hard. Reconciliation is really hard work, but it's so beautiful and so redemptive when you take that step. And some of the sort of worldly wisdom out there is really not helpful. Time heals all wounds. Really? love means never having to say I'm sorry. I hear these phrases, right? They're common phrases, but they're some of the biggest lies that are out there. And so we tend to just sweep under the carpet the conflicts in our lives. And I mean, from the perspective of just marriage, friendship, but also leadership, I found actually, you know, pursuing reconciliation, and, you know, there's sort of a Christian framework for reconciliation, which is, in a sense, the ball is always in your court. And so there are different passages in the Bible, some of which say if someone has something against you,
yes,
go to them and work it through. But it also says if you have something against someone else, go and work it through.
Yes.
And I realized at some point that actually my instincts are opposite on both counts. If somebody has something against me, I'm like, well, you know, you're the one who has the problem, so you should come and talk to me about it.
Sure.
But if I have something against someone else, I think, well, you're the one who's in the wrong, so you should know that, and you should come talk to me.
Ask for forgiveness, right?
Exactly. So it's really challenging to me that actually my faith tradition challenges me with the opposite approach, a more intentional approach, an approach where the ball's in my court to go to others and seek reconciliation. And I've come now to the point where, you know, I've done that so many times that conflict is always painful, but there's also now a sense even within it of hopefulness, maybe even expectancy, because so many times I've seen a conflict actually be able to be reconciled. And then on the other side of reconciliation, you find the relationship is even stronger than had the conflict not happened in the first place.
Agreed.
Which I just think is a beautiful thing.
Agreed. You know, and Vince, sometimes I love that what you said, the ball's always in your court. Because sometimes you try to reconcile, and it doesn't mean just because you try that it always works.
That's right.
In fact, you know, we are to live at peace with all men as much as it depends on us, right? We're only
Absolutely.
Responsible for us. We cannot be responsible for the response of the other person, right?
That's absolutely right. And, you know, sometimes we feel that, you know, we're 2% in the wrong and someone else is 98% in the wrong. But, you know, I had a friend who used to say, you are 100% responsible for your 2%.
There you go.
It's amazing how when you start with that attitude, you know, you often wind up realizing it's a lot closer to 50-50 than I thought when I got started on the process.
Right. That is so good. Well, let me ask you this. Let's talk about, and then we'll talk about the theology of work. Let's talk about leadership a little bit.
Sure.
And this is funny to me because sometimes we even see, like, people sometimes in their role, you kind of need to understand what good looks like. Sometimes we don't even really understand what good looks like then. So tell me, in your mind and from your studies in that, what does good leadership look like?
Sure, a big a question. And I feel like I've gone on a real respect to my own thoughts on that question, because, you know, I shared a little bit about my sort of childhood and some of the things that were deeply ingrained in me. And some of those were wonderful, wonderful things. You know, there's both the good and the bad. But I realized, you know, reflecting on my childhood, that with competitive sports being so formative and that kind of bleeding out into the rest of life, you know, good life, good leadership was always about being the best, being better than other people, beating others. Life was about sort of amassing trophies and winning at all costs. And, you know, the interesting thing is that philosophy of life can sometimes lead to you winding up in leadership positions because, you know, you work harder, you give that 100%, you work harder than the people around you and maybe better as well. But I don't actually think that sets you up to be a good leader, because at the root of this sort of win at all costs approach to life is a preferencing of oneself over others. And, you know, that's something that I didn't have the maturity to reflect on until much later in life. My approach was always, I need to do better than the next guy. I need to win and he needs to lose. I need to have the most trophies. But I do think if you draw out the trajectory of that mindset and sort of heart attitude, it can lead to some places that you don't want to be. That this sort of intense focus on the self and, you know, my accomplishments, my achievements can naturally lead to a selfishness, a pride, a narcissism, you know, some of the qualities that are actually the opposite of a mm-hmm. good leader. So mm-hmm. I feel like I've learned at times the hard way, sometimes through failure, you know, what good leadership can actually look like. And I actually think in some ways it's the opposite of what I've spoken and what was deeply ingrained in me, and that it's actually about putting others before yourself. And even as I was reflecting on this podcast, I just started to think about the word leader. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of interesting, even the word points to this. Definitionally, it's not possible to be a leader unless there are people you are leading. You know, you can't be a leader on your own. When we call someone a leader, we actually define that person in relation to others. So, you know, quite to the contrary of being a leader by winning out over others or being in power over others, it's only those who follow who actually have the power to make a leader a leader. And that's just so different from the way that I used to think about leadership, which was all about being self-made, self-reliant, self-assured, mm-hmm. all this, you know, focus on the self. And I just wonder if even by definition, a leader has to be other reliant, other centered, and really therefore an act of service. And so I've realized, and I'm continuing to realize, that there was sort of this inconsistency in my view of leadership where, you know, Lisa, if you asked me who are the greatest leaders, you know, to ever live, I would list a bunch of people who are characterized by loving, selfless, sacrificial service of others. But then if I took an honest look at how I was trying to achieve leadership, it was actually much more focused opposite on myself and actually mm-hmm. winning out over other people, beating other people, being better than other people. So there was really a sort of reorientation that had to happen in my understanding of leadership, and I'm really thankful for it.
What if it's about leading others to be their best self?
Absolutely. Instead
of, you know, us being better than other people, leading others to be the best version of themselves. That's a good leader.
I think that's absolutely right. You know, this idea of valuing others above yourself. So the focus actually being on leading others to be their best self, and sort of you become your best self in the process, right?
But
almost when you finally get your eyes off of yourself mm-hmm. and focused on someone else. And mm-hmm. some of these themes are so deeply ingrained. I have a 3 and a 5-year-old, so
yes.
I'm struggling with this at the moment as they just begin to enter into even a sporting context. Like my 3-year-old did his first little soccer team and he's 3 years old, but we get in the car. I mean, I put him in the car seat and he goes, "We're going to win. I'm going to beat them."
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
And it's at least, I love sports and I continue to love sports mm-hmm. and I continue to love competition, but it's worth reflecting deeply on, and I'm having to as a parent now, okay, do I want that to be my 3-year-old's primary motivation for, you know, working, you know, mm-hmm. and it starts out as sports and you kind of symbolically train for work later in life. You know, do I want his primary motivation to be, I want to beat others, you know, interesting, mm-hmm. even choice of terminology there. So this is real life for me. I'm like wrestling with what this looks like in the context of trying mm-hmm. to set the trajectory in part for my children.
Sure. I love it. Because I was going to ask you, I know you probably know Dr. Tim Irwin, you know, with CEO Forum. And I was going to ask you, Vince, about what you've seen that derails leaders. And I think what we just talked about, a lot of that where it's all about you, that's when the leader starts to believe the press that they see, you know, and Dr. Irwin talks about that sometimes those leaders that get derailed are the leaders that kind of put themselves above and even above authority, even above standard operating procedures. Well, I can bend the rules here because I'm the leader, you know, and then it's a terrible slippery slope. Well, let me ask you this. Do you have a favorite leadership quote?
Oh, well, there's one that I apply to leadership, you know, at least, and I've been thinking about lately, and it's by Annie Dillard, the author, and she says, the way you live your days is, of course, the way you live your life. And I just found that very challenging, because, you know, there are some ways that I want to be remembered at the end of my life. And I hope my children will say, Dad was this sort of person. It's easy for me to kind of identify those things abstractly. But then if I kind of hone in and say, hey, how do I spend my days? How do I live my days? What do I value in my days? What is the distribution of my time and my money and my emotion and my energy in the context of day to day? And boy, that really needs to align with how I'm hoping to live my life.
Right.
Right. It's not possible to not serve people day to day and somehow at the end of your life wind up having lived a life of service.
Exactly.
So, you know, I'm finding that very challenging at the moment, applying that quote to leadership and almost wanting to kind of, you know, list out, say, hey, what are the things that I want to characterize my life at the end of life? And then saying, are those true of my average day? And if not, what sort of very concrete, tangible goals do I need to set to make sure those are disciplined parts of my day to day?
You know, Vince, I'm just thinking, and I'm thinking it, and so I'm going to say it out loud. I'm thinking it, so I might as well say it out loud. But I'm just thinking about you talking about your children. You have got an amazing role model in Rick Lytle, Dr. Rick Lytle.
Hear, hear.
Because he has been so intentional with his parenting. And yeah, I was just thinking, you've got a wonderful role model right there in Dr. Rick Lytle, who leads the CEO Forum. I'm going to ask you one other question and then we'll take a quick break and we'll get into some other things. But, you know, can you, because I know the theology of work is something that's really of interest to you. I can surmise, I can say what I think that you mean by that, but I would rather hear it from you. What does that mean, the theology of work?
So partly, I think that is thinking about the value of our work from a faith perspective, and in my case, from a Christian perspective, because sometimes we think of work as this kind of hard thing that we need to do because we live in a sort of broken world. But, you know, thank God it's Friday. You know, we finally get to Friday and then we don't need to work for 2 days. Isn't that wonderful? And rest is a great thing. You know, I affirm that. But thinking through the value and even the sanctity that work is sacred. You know, interestingly, actually, you know, in the Old Testament, the word for work and the word for worship and the word for service are all the same word, avodah. And so there's sort of this alignment between our work and that which should be worshipful, sort of an act of gratitude for what we've received, and that which should serve others as well. And so I find it very encouraging that even from a biblical perspective, there was work before the fall, before any brokenness entered the world. God created people and told them to work the garden that he created. And then, you know, Jesus spent probably about 18 years in a most of his adult life in a secular profession.
Carpentry.
Of a carpentry.
Yes.
And then only 3 years in what we, you know, today call, you know, full-time ministry, which is probably a sort of misnomer because all of our work can be ministry. And then interestingly, even thinking towards heaven, you know, if you actually look at what the Bible has to say, we have a very misconceived notion of heaven as where, you know, we're just going to sing all the time. And if we don't have very good voices, we get kind of depressed by that. But it actually says we're going to reign with Christ, that there's going to be like dominion over this earth, but the earth redeemed and a kind of new creation. But it says very explicitly that there's going to be work in the context of heaven, work that is truly, fully fulfilling. You know, almost like the distinction between work and play will sort of break down and we'll just have such joy in our work. So work was created in the beginning. It's supposed to be part of our service and even our worship today. And it's something that's supposed to stick with us, you know, for all eternity. I just find that very encouraging as I work to think, actually, this is something which is not just temporary and transient and something I have to do because I happen to live in a world which is broken in a variety of ways. No, this is part of my who I am, who God made me to be. And it's leading towards an eternal significance that will continue beyond this life as well.
That's so good, man. That's so good. Well, as you were talking, I was thinking about John Beckett. And you probably know John and
I
his
do.
book, Loving Mondays. Loving Mondays. And it's not just that TGIF. Oh my God.
Absolutely.
He's like, learn to love Mondays because that is where, we can truly have influence and impact, and not that we don't with our families. We need to be there too. But it just made me think of John. Well, okay, I said I was going to ask you one more, and then we'll take a break. But I'm going to ask you one more.
Great.
Let's talk about faith in sports. So I think you have traveled with Athletes in Action to four different continents. I mean, there may be listeners, and I don't know a lot. I've heard Athletes in Action a lot, Vince, but I don't know a lot about it. Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about Athletes in Action? Then I promise we're going to take a quick break.
Great, sure. No, these were amazing experiences. You know, it was the community that first journeyed with me on my journey to faith, but then they put together sports teams that play in particular in the summers and will go to different countries. So I was playing soccer for the university during the year, but then in the summers I could join this Athletes in Action team, and we would go to different countries around the world, usually for about 3 weeks at a time, play against their professional teams. And it's amazing how, you know, once you've spent 90 minutes on a field competing with one another, there's like a level of trust and bonding. You know, before the game, there would have been no sort of avenues for communication. After it was sort of tell us who you are and what you're about and what's important to you. So we would go and have a meal together and be able to share our perspectives on life. Then on the off days, we would do different service projects and camps for kids and different things. It was just a really formative time in my life. And, you know, I hadn't thought about this before the podcast, but maybe even part of where that relationship between, you know, work and leadership and service came to the fore in my life.
Very good. Well, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be back with Vince Vitale on the Something Extra podcast.
Hey there. In a challenging business climate like this, savvy leaders look to technology to find an edge. This can mean the difference between staying ahead of the curve or playing catch up. It's time to collaborate with the highly skilled experts at Technology Partners. Our team of technologists draws upon decades of experience for your project, with each bringing a passion for solving problems and a track record of success. How can we help you overcome your biggest technology challenges? Visit technologypartners.net to book a free consultation with one of our leaders.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Something Extra podcast with my friend Vince. So, Vince, this is crazy to me. I mean, you have been able to speak about your Christian faith to so many different universities, Harvard, Princeton, Yale, Columbia, UC Berkeley, West Point, many others. You've also spoken at some very well-known, iconic organizations like Google and Amazon and Facebook. I want to ask you, how did these opportunities come about, and what topics did you address when you spoke at these places? And are there any that are particularly ones that maybe stand out to you that you can tell us a little bit about?
Sure, it's been such a privilege to speak in these different contexts, and you know, it often might be a person of faith in that context who wants to create a space for a dialogue between different worldviews. Oftentimes, it might be a situation where you're actually hearing different perspectives on a deep question of life at the same time, which I just think is so healthy and refreshing. In particular, in our culture, which seems to be characterized by such division and by not disagreeing well. I think we're not good at disagreement as a culture. So that's something that I'm really passionate about. And actually, that's one of the topics that recently I've been speaking in these types of venues about. What does it look like to disagree well? And people are really engaged on that topic because whether it's in the context of political divisions or racial divisions or divisions in your company or divisions in your family, people are really struggling, I think, in the context of the sort of narratives and approaches to disagreement in our current culture, to figure out just what does that look like when you feel yourself emotionally intensely disagreeing with someone, what has to happen in the moments between feeling those emotions and then something useful actually coming out of your mouth? Like, what's the approach that actually has to happen in the in the brain and in the heart? So that's one, you know, topic. Another topic that I've been speaking on recently is how to deal with anxiety and sort of the burdens of life, which is just relevant to anyone, regardless of what worldview or faith perspective you may or may not be coming from. But different ways of seeing the world give different answers. And I don't think that they're all the same. So that creates, you know, fantastic opportunity for dialogue as well. So yeah, oftentimes the invitation might come from somebody who just has a heart to bring into even the workplace, like meaningful conversations, so that people feel like they can bring their whole selves to work, even if there is disagreement, and then actually disagree well in a way that actually promotes unity and collaboration rather than leading to divisiveness and polarization. So that, yeah, that's a bit about the approach that my wife, Jo, and I take as we head into these venues.
Yeah. Well, that's, I mean, you're talking about subjects, to your point, that everyone deals with. And that's here's right. One that everyone deals with. And I would love for you to camp out here a little bit, Vince. You wrote a book. You've written several books, but one of the books that you wrote is Why Suffering? And how do you approach this topic of suffering? Because I hear that a lot. You know, how can there be, you know, the existence of God and then allowing people to, you know, the pain and the suffering that comes along with just being human, right?
Yes, yes. It's a perennial question, one of the most difficult questions, because it's both difficult intellectually, but it's also, you know, very difficult at the heart level for every person, really, who either has dealt with suffering or is dealing with it or will at some point. And we talked a bit about how I, you know, got into this topic in the first place. You know, I mean, I think as I approach this topic, you know, at the outset, it's helpful for me to approach it with humility and recognize that I'm not going to wind up with a perfect answer. Maybe one day in the context of eternity, I'll understand more. But if I am talking about the reasons of an infinite God, his ways are going to be higher than my ways. The world that he created, how it has ensued, what he allows and doesn't allow. And yet at the same time, you know, from my Christian perspective, I believe in a God who wants us to know him in some substantial way, in a relational way. So I also have this kind of expectation that I can understand something of who God is and why perhaps he acts the way that he does. So finding that balance there between not expecting that I'm going to have a perfect answer, but also pursuing understanding as part of my, you know, pursuit of understanding who God is. The other thing which is, you know, really significant to me on this question from the perspective of the Christian tradition is to have a God who knows suffering in a very concrete
very well
way,
acquainted with suffering.
You know, not in an abstract sense, but I remember once one of my very good friends was going through something very difficult, and I remember at the time he was not a Christian, not a person of faith, but he said to me, "I need a counselor who has been through what I'm going through." And I thought that was such a profound statement. And I sort of shared with him that one of the nomenclatures for Jesus in the Bible is wonderful counselor. And he's only wonderful because he really has, you know, been through the depths of suffering that we experience in this life. And in the context of my research, PhD research, many approaches to this question, but I'll just share for, you know, a couple minutes, one approach, which oftentimes people have not thought of, but I think is significant and has been significant in my life, which is that when we think about the suffering in the world, we tend to picture ourselves and the people that we love in this world with all of its suffering. Then we picture ourselves and the people that we love in a very different world with far less suffering or no suffering. And we think to ourselves, well, why wouldn't God create me and the people that I love in that very different world that doesn't have that suffering. But we tend not to ask the question, would it still be you and me and the people that we love if God had allowed to exist that very different world that we think we wish he had allowed to exist? And that's kind of an abstract thought, but it became very concrete for my wife, Jo, and I, when we had a miscarriage, which we experienced very intensely, the grief of that. And not too long afterward, Jo was pregnant again. And at some point in that process, we realized that our now three-year-old, JJ, literally couldn't have existed had we not miscarried our daughter prior to him, because Jo still would have been pregnant with her when she conceived JJ. So now, from the context of my understanding of reality as a Christian, I think of my family as this family of five, and Jonathan's middle name is Lucian, to point back to our daughter Luca's name, who we lost in that miscarriage. And there's this kind of amazing redemption that he only exists because of, in a sense, this sacrifice that she made. But we have this hope to a future life where we really think that all five of us
we'll
could
be together.
Together again. And I think, wow, that's incredible. I mean, that is no longer abstract. That is like very concrete to the way I think about my family and the gratitude that I have, you know, for my son and the way that these events have unfolded. And so, you know, even going back to my Aunt Regina, who I spoke about earlier, who was speaking about the suffering in her son's life, you know, he had a variety of disabilities in his life, you know, and some of them were genetic in nature as well. And again, it raises that question: would the people that we love have existed if God instead allowed to exist this very different world that in our heads we think we want him to have allowed to exist? And could it be the case that God actually chose each of us and each of the people that we love and the world that would allow for the circumstances that would bring them into existence because he saw value in them and because he desired to love them and invite each of them into relationship with himself? So that's one approach which has been very significant to me and very sort of personal to our family life as well.
Yeah. Wow. My head is spinning here. Vince, I could tell. I love the way you think. You know, asking these really deep, hard questions, I think, is really something that we sometimes shy away from. But I think it's really good to have some discourse and to talk about. You're very, you know, you're very passionate about apologetics. And, you know, I would love for you to just talk a little bit about that. And, you know, this statement, and apologetics comes from the word apologia, right? Which
means That's right.
Defense. Talk about this statement a little bit. You say apologetics in the absence of evangelism is an exercise without merit.
Yeah. And so, you know, as I think about apologetics, I guess what I'm getting at there is I feel like it needs to be invitational. You know, you can think of defense in a very combative way, where you're talking about ideas rather than people. And I feel like in the context of apologetics is one word which is, you know, used for this idea of really just taking people's questions seriously. It's really the way that I went on my journey to faith and the way that I was journeyed with by this community that first invited me into their community, into journeying together. And so, you know, apologia, that Greek word sometimes kind of, you know, just makes people feel like this idea, this discipline is kind of detached and disconnected You know, my wife and I, we think about apologetics as really a ministry of reconciliation. So it's really interesting that you focused in that theme at a couple of points in this podcast. And so oftentimes when we think about this, people think about helping people to reconcile to God in a kind of vertical way. Mm-hmm. We think about it in a holistic way where there is that reconciliation vertically, but there's also this mm-hmm. reconciliation that needs to take place horizontally. Person to mm-hmm. person, between people groups within society. And then there's also a reconciliation that needs to take place internally as well. And so many of the questions that we get today are all about some feeling of fracturing or brokenness within the self. And so the way that I understand, you know, what we're doing when we do apologetics is really inviting people into a reconciled life and inviting them into that in a holistic way where you can be reconciled in your identity within yourself, with the people around you and your neighbors and community, but also to God.
Mm-hmm. That's so good. I'm going to be thinking about that reconciliation within yourself, horizontally and vertically. It's really kind of a 360. Mm. Well, you and Joe have your own podcast. Mine's called Something Extra. Yours is called Ask Away. I can only surmise what it's about, but yep. You guys basically probably take people's questions and just do deep dives on them, I would imagine.
Yeah, exactly right. We do. People send in their deep questions of life, and we don't have all the answers, but we have a conversation about their question. We love that the podcast prompts us to be thinking deeply. And so it's my wife, Jo, and I on the podcast, and she's from England. So she has a much nicer accent than mine. So if you have not enjoyed mine, don't be put off. Her British accent is worth listening to.
From but New Jersey.
That's right. I know, like a guy from Jersey, you know, marries an English rose with a British accent. I never win the vote for who has the nicest accent contest.
An English rose. That's funny.
But the podcast is the idea behind the podcast is really that every question is a gift. Every mm-hmm. question has a true answer. We may not have the perfect answer, but every question has a true answer. And from my perspective, from our perspective, all truth is in some way grounded in who God is. And yeah. So we just deal with people's questions, and we welcome any and every question. We receive them as a gift and trust that that will lead us towards truth and therefore towards God as well.
That's so good. That's so good. Well, I hope our listeners go out and check that podcast out, put it in your favorites, and tune in to Joe and Vince. So I've got a little lightning round for you here, and then we'll talk about something extra. So what do you guys do for fun? I know you do sports.
Yes.
soccer.
I surf. Surfing is the thing that rests me and refreshes me most. We're living in the Bay Area in California now, so it's the first time I've actually gotten to live somewhere where I can do that just about weekly. So about once a week, I get to go out and surf, and I'm really thankful for that. And it's a great sport, as my, you know, ACL repaired knee and my torn ankles, you know, get older. Surfing is actually pretty low impact. So I hope to do it for a long time, at least to do it long enough that when my 3 and 5 year old are old enough, we can do it together.
Yes, for sure. What about a morning routine? Do you have a morning routine?
I have a 3 and a 5 year old. So morning routine is not as consistent as I would like it to be, but time with the boys, usually helping them learn in some sort of way in the morning, and then, you know, I'll spend time. My church is a small church, and we're all on the same reading plan, which is actually really cool. So we actually like all read the same thing every day, and then as you're just interacting in relationship, you find like your conversations go deeper and revolve around some important themes. So that's a significant part somewhere early in the day, and then I often try to get over to the YMCA, and I have found in this last season they have some good sort of open workspaces, and I'll often even just work over there. I find that if I am working in walking distance of exercise, it's actually really healthy for me. And when I start to kind of hit the wall a bit, even if it's just like 10, 15 minutes, I'll go mm-hmm. do some exercise, come back to work. I actually find I get more work done. But then at the end of the day, I've also gotten my cholesterol in a little bit better place.
In a little bit.
So that's been helpful.
Oh, oh, you've lowered your LDL. And
exactly.
So, oh my goodness. That is so true. And Greg and I often talk about that. You know, I'll like take a walk. You know, I'm just like, okay, I'm just going to break it up a minute. I'm going to take a walk. And you think it's kind of an oxymoron, Vince, because you think, oh, if I go exercise, I'm going to be more tired. But it does kind of give you, you know, that extra oomph, I think, you know, to go another round. So I love
Totally
that.
agree.
So what's next for you? Do you have another book in the works?
My wife and I are working on a book. We call it The Spiritual Discipline of Conversation. You know,
that
because if
sounds
I,
awesome.
yeah, if I ask most people about the disciplines in their life, a conversation doesn't normally make the list. But it's actually such a significant part of life and such a significant part of how we interact with others and how we build relationships. And there's actually a lot of highly practical, tangible, realistic goals that we can set and sort of even preparation that we can do for a much higher percentage of our conversations to wind up in just these meaningful areas of life rather than just shooting the breeze. And there's all sorts of benefits that come from that. So that's something we're working on at the moment.
I love it. And it's going to be so good for your boys, for JJ and Raphael. That's going to be so good for them. You know?
Yeah. It's not good. It's not going to be good for us though. Cause then they'll be able to read like, hey, in chapter 7, you said that you should respond to that situation in this way, but dad, you don't usually respond that way. So there's going to be some inbuilt accountability as well.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Vince, this is called Something Extra. What do you believe is the something extra every leader needs?
You know, I was trying to almost like sum up the variety of directions that my thoughts were going as I was thinking about us recording this podcast. And I guess if I had to almost pick a word, I would pick humility. I think humility is so significant for leadership. Often I think, you know, misunderstood word, you know, humility is not thinking less of yourself, but in a sense, thinking of yourself less, and not just talking about yourself, you know, less, but it's actually valuing others above yourself. And, you know, that's maybe an easy thing to talk about abstractly, but I find it's really a difficult thing to live out and put into practice. I've been making a list of sentences that, in my experience, humble people regularly say, and I have four main sentences on this list, and it's I don't know, I was wrong, I need help, and will you forgive me? And those are all quite vulnerable sentences, which are willing to be transparent, willing to show weakness. And in that sense, they're typically not what we associate with leaders, because leaders are supposed to not show vulnerability or weakness, you know, so we're told. But I think those four sentences are true of every finite, fallible human person. Every human person. There's a lot we don't know. There's a lot that we get wrong. There are many times we need help. And there are times where we need to say to people, you know, will you forgive me? And so I've almost been using these four sentences as a kind of barometer in my own life. Are those sentences coming out of my mouth regularly, or am I sort of fighting not to have to say them at every turn? And I think the beautiful thing in the context of leadership is that when you actually start to say these things and believe them in your heart, then I think it just promotes trust and safety and a sort of dynamic collaboration across teams and across communities. So, you know, in some ways, even that childhood extreme competition in sports, for all the good of it, you know, was also maybe this negative side where you can't show weakness or not knowing or not being able to do. And I've kind of, you know, swung in another direction, that actually there's real strength in being able to admit weakness and therefore admit your need for other people and therefore earn their trust and therefore be able to work with them well.
Oh, this has been so good. Vince, thank you so, so much. I've seriously, absolutely loved every minute of this time with you. And I just know that our listeners are going to be helped, and, Yeah, I'm excited. I just want to spend more time with you and Joe. So we'll see each other at the annual forum in October at least. But thank you so much, my friend, for making the time to be on the show today.
Thank you. These have been wonderful topics to think through. I feel like I've learned a lot from just the process. So truly, thank you for the invitation.
Thank you for listening to today's show. Something Extra with Lisa Nichols is a Technology Partners production. Copyright Technology Partners, Inc., 2019. For show notes or to reach Lisa, visit tpi.co/podcast. Don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen.